guys. I'm K2 Romeo Indy. My name is Dick, and at this time we begin the TechNet. For those who haven't heard it before, we hope there are a few of those. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. We gather people who have inquisitiveness and curiosity, who want to know more about radio equipment, how to make it work better, how does it work. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. And the one you're listening to right now, 2 meter FM, repeater ham radio, is just one of the 26 kinds. Extremely educational hobby. It's an extremely educational hobby. I don't know one that's more educational than ham radio. And doesn't have to be expensive. And it can be, depending on how you want to do it. Some guys are extremely good at homebrewing equipment, particularly antennas. Very few of us homebrew our 8 or 10 meter all-mode transceivers these days. We buy them from Southeast Asia with a couple of weeks' worth of salary. It would take you a year to construct that, so you're way ahead of the game to buy a respected brand name, one that's got some track record to it. And as such, if you don't like it, there's a good chance you can sell it and get a good fraction of your money back again. But when it comes to antennas, we build those. And when it comes to microwave equipment, a good percentage of that is homebrewed by ham radio operators. Let me drop. The ham radio operators, they move up in frequency about 10 to 1, roughly every decade or so. Right now, the frontier is somewhere above 10 gigahertz. There's quite a few guys building equipment for 22 and 47 and 78 gigahertz and 120 gigahertz. So the frontier is well above 10 gigahertz today. And there's only a relatively small percentage of hardcore guys that are doing that. And we used to think that those frequencies were only good for a very short range line of sight. And they're breaking distance records all the time, doing moon bounce with it, among other things. Developing transmitters and receivers up there is a bit of a challenge, particularly trying to get any real power. A high-powered guy on 22 gigahertz is running a fraction of a watt of power. That's not considered QRP up there, and he gets a lot of gain out of a fairly small antenna. Let me drop. The TechNet has a kind of a loose schedule that we follow. That loose schedule is that for the first hour, we take general questions. People sign in because they've got a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're listening. After 33 years, TechNet began in 1982. After 33 years, we have good reason to believe that somebody is listening, so that it doesn't have to be proven anymore. What you're listening to is the beginning of TechNet number 1,579 of the series. So the first hour is general questions. People who do have a question or a comment sign in with their name and their call letters. That's followed by John, KC2WGV, who maintains the mailbag, and he also watches the Echo Link connection. So if you have trouble signing in with Echo Link, John will know about it. He'll alert us to that. And this way you can even send him messages, so to speak, for people who even manage to get their question to John by way of the internet for Echo Link. Let me drop. After John covers 2, 3, or 4 general interest questions that he got from people by way of the so-called mailbag, those are people who don't yet have the ham license, they're working toward it, or they don't have the right equipment so they can talk to us directly. And so he chooses a few of those mail-ins, so to speak, and we cover those questions. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, a space expert, who tells us what NASA is doing. And we'll probably be discussing a little bit of the latest issue of Scientific American magazine, which has a couple of very interesting space-oriented articles. So we'll be discussing those. So this is the loose schedule. And depending on the amount of enthusiasm, the amount of interest, any one of those sections can be shrunk down or stretched out. There are times when the general questions section, that usually is about an hour, has lasted more than 2 hours. Well, there are times when the mailbag section, which is frequently in the half-hour, 45-minute period, if we get some real good questions and a whole lot of enthusiastic discussion going on, we can go a heck of a lot longer than that. So it's not... One other point is that don't be afraid that you think your question is not up to our standards. There is no such thing. What the guy knows, his ability to express himself, and what he would like to know. Therefore, it's the question most deserving of an answer. The dumb question is the one most deserving of an answer. So we try not to have the elitist attitude saying that, hey, that question is, we're not going to cover that because it's beneath our station. There's no such thing. We've all started off putting up very simple antennas and not having the vaguest idea how they work. Just to give you an example, I used to think that the coaxial cable gave you a capacitive coupling between the center conductor and the outer shield. So therefore, my first antenna, I used as transmission line a non-coaxial cable, just a simple piece of wire, if you know what I mean. So I thought I was putting up a dipole. I really was putting up a long wire. And I had the misunderstanding of how a transmission line worked. And that was my beginning in my ham radio days when I was cutting my teeth in this business when I was 16 years of age. Okay, at this time we're going to take chickens of people who do have a question or a comment. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, try to remember your name to tell me, because I'm kind of forgetful, followed by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Also, try to leave enough space. Don't worry about whether or not you're going to get your name in. We'll wait long enough to get everybody. But try to leave enough space where you hear all four beeps so the whole system can properly get reset so we don't time it out. So give me a call letters and name right now. K2LIW, the TechNet.
Rich with a question at 2EO.
WH1
Great.
Okay, so far I've heard Rich and Joe, and on the input I'm hearing other stations that are not coming through the repeater. Either they get covered up or they don't have a PL turned on. So I got Rich and Joe. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW in TechNet.
Mike, K2MFR, for the question.
K2WGB with a quick question.
Comment?
Okay, I picked up Mike, MFR. I think it's Kilo 2 Mike, Foxtrot Romeo. I picked up John, WGB. And there's another person with a question or a comment. Who else was that? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, John, KD2JF, Chris, with a comment.
Okay, John, KD2JAF, I think that was. Sounds like you think you have a point of order and you should be covered first, so see if I interpreted that correctly. KD2 Juliet Alpha Foxtrot, if I got it right. K2LIW, go ahead, John. They got the name wrong. Was there a KD2JAF who signed in?
Yeah, John, it's KD2JAF, it's Chris.
Okay, you're saying it so fast. I think I'm hearing Kilo, Delta 2, Juliet, Alpha, Foxtrot. That's what I think I'm hearing. Go ahead, Chris.
We're taking a second for the tail drop up on the repeat. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's Chris, John. You got it right.
You said Chris, and then you said John. So I'm confused. Mr. JAF, please tell me what your comment is and what your real name is. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, the name is Chris, KD2JAF.
Okay, I think you said you had a comment, Chris. So go right ahead with your comment.
Okay, Dick. I thought I was going to save it for later. I just said I brought back on this show a few weeks back about a program issue I had with the Falcon radios, the 5BQs. I discovered the issue, what it was. There's anomalies that are specific to different lot numbers of those radios. If anybody had problems using the Chirp software, when you were going to upload the program to the radio, you would get a series of symbols that were completely alien to me. So if anybody has the same issue, like somebody else had the same issue with a Baofeng, I don't think it's the same exact issue. If you upload the program that's in the radio, scrub it, keep it as a separate file, then you can copy your files and then upload it back to the radio, and then it works to get you on, but you have to have a separate file for that radio alone. That was my comment from a few weeks ago.
Very fine, Chris. Yeah, I know that there are different lot numbers and serial numbers of the Balfong radios, even when you're talking about the five number, five BU, five U, I've forgotten the full call letters, the full number of the thing. But there's a three and a five, and different lot numbers have different amounts of modulation. And Bernie, KQIO, and I have had a number of discussions on that. I know that some of them are super narrow, even though you've programmed them into the wide mode because they're made to the new FCC mandate, and some of the ones are not, depending on when they were built and how long ago. Okay, we're going to go in the issue, and we're going to go in the order in which people signed in. Rich was the first question person who signed in. N2EO, KQIW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, good evening, N2EO. Yes, I have a question concerning high power on HF radio to 10 meters. You know, when you and Barry put the antenna up, I have a PS590, it runs 100 watts. And so, Barry, N2MB is telling me to hand me 2K4. It sits on the floor, it's a console unit, it's got a large transformer and a choke. It's choke input supply. So, the amplifier's on top. My questions are on, it's got bulbs. It's got two, I don't know if they're 1847 or 47s. And I'm wondering what the difference is, and where can I get small quantity of blue LED replacements? I don't want to spend a lot of money to get them. All I need is two. So maybe Mauser, but they probably have a minimum order. The other thing is the coax on this antenna, and I use ladder line on HF. It runs parallel to each other. Patty thought it was kind of messy. So Barry ordered from his alarm distributor a wide molding. He uses it on in his alarm work. And he's going to stick it to the wall to keep everything neat and house the coax and the ladder line. Now, I'm wondering, first of all, with the coax and the ladder line arc? And the second question, if they don't arc, will the ladder line couple too much RF into the coax to damage the Tamiya 440 radio? Back to you, Dick, and Tamiya.
Okay, I'm going to express a number of opinions on this one. I'm not sure I've got everything exactly right. I'm going to take them in reverse order. High-power HF, its ability to give damage to a 2-meter 440 radio is very light, very small. In other words, every reasonable design of 2-meter 440 radio has a kind of front-end design bandpass filter, which will, particularly HF signal appearing on the outside of the coax, and for that signal to climb on the inside of the coax to get out of the semiconductor for your application, very unlikely, so I wouldn't worry about that one. But when it comes to the ladder line itself, to get full performance out of it, you'd like to have no nearby metallic objects. By nearby, I mean less than an inch away. You'd like all metallic objects to be more than an inch away from each of the two leads of the ladder line, is my belief. Closer metallic contact than that. Like if you took your coax cable and laid it completely parallel to the ladder line, and then wrapped the two with black tape, so to speak, that would not be making proper use of the ladder line. The coax wouldn't give a darn. Let me drop. In that environment, the coax would keep right on cranking. But the ladder line, if that had something like coax cable lying parallel to it for more than a couple of inches. So it's a real significant coupling over feet of distance. Then your ladder line is going to become somewhat unbalanced. You shoot quite a bit of RF energy onto the coax. And it's not a showstopper, but it's less than ideal. So some separation between those two should take place. I'm pretty sure Barry's got enough ways of constantly using a molding in order to make that happen. When it comes to molding material, that's really an insulated material made out of plastic or wood. That laying cut against the ladder line, very little problem with that. It would take some extremely dense dielectric material over a long distance, favoring one side of the ladder line versus the other side of the ladder line to start making it act in an unbalanced manner. Very unlikely. So as long as the ladder line is not making any really sharp bends, and even that you can tolerate quite a bit of it, is my experience, but the recommendation is don't make any really sharp bends with the ladder line, and try to keep it away from metallic objects. Then you get full performance out of it. And the fact that you're running close to a kilowatt on the ladder line, not much of a problem. That ladder line can easily take the kind of power. Your particular antenna can easily take the power. So I don't think that's much of a problem. Now, when it comes to the light bulbs, 1847 light bulbs. I'm not quite sure if that is a 6 volt or a 12 volt light bulb, but there's lots of different. Let me drop. There's lots of different pilot lights that would work in that application. And for a crafty guy that's willing to take almost any kind of light emitting diode and put the right kind of a series resistor in series with the light-emitting diode, he can easily make a substitute for the incandescent bulbs that used to be there as a pilot light. And there's a lot of advantage in doing that. Quite a bit more efficient and extremely long life. Ordinary incandescent-type pilot light bulbs have a finite life to them, after which they burn out and don't give you brilliance anymore. So what I'm trying to say is that to switch over to a light-emitting diode is a relatively simple operation. The fact that you're putting 60 cycles of AC into a light-emitting diode is not a problem once you choose the right series resistor. A couple of very simple experiments. If you didn't want to do the calculation, you could do a couple of very simple experiments with putting a resistor in series with the light-emitting diode to see how much resistance gives you how much brilliance. Yeah, go ahead on that one, John. KC2WGB, a light bulb expert. I bet you've done that. You only own 400 pieces of test equipment, so imagine you replace a few light bulbs in your time. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
K2WGB. Yes, I have, and I got fed up with it, so I did a little conversion. Maybe Rich would like to try. I chose some from China. I have like 30 LEDs, multiple colors, for like $4. And I took the 47 base bulbs, or the 1800 series, cracked the glass, dug it out, put the little resistor inside, put the LED, and mounted it right back in a bin and socket. Worked beautifully.
Sounds like a good idea there, John. Now, I presume what you did is to put a small series resistor into the light-emitting diode that you wired into the socket of the number 47 bayonet light bulb base where you broke off the glass. Just to use the base so you had something to easily reconstruct it back into the socket of your piece of equipment. And there are some people who think that you have to put in rectifying diodes. I think you don't. With the right chosen series resistor straight into the light-emitting diode, they're pretty happy with running on AC or DC. Is that approximately what you found, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW, and TechNet?
Absolutely right. I believe it's best if you put a small diode in there, but I did a few that I didn't use a diode, but it only used half the present energy, of course, and it worked well. I think the resistor value was somewhere around 68 ohms, if I remember correctly, and they worked very well, and I adjusted the resistance to get just above the minimum glow, so I don't have to worry about the energy being too much to burn them out. Don't even know what the voltage was. I did all by eye, and they worked fine.
This is too low. 20 milliamps, maximum.
So you think 68 ohms is too low? 6 volts and 68 milliamps would be roughly 100 milliamps of peak current in the forward mode, but that's only half the time. So I guess you're guessing, Eric, that 100 ohms or 150 ohms would be a good number to start with, KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, you want to light up the room, you want a pilot light, you know. If you're working with 6 volts, you know, 1K is a nice value. Low current, single band forever. By the way, LEDs do fail. They do have a life, but they're usually longer than you live. But there are, let's see, there's a couple of companies that make bayonet-based, essentially they're 47 replacement bulbs, which are LEDs. If you go to digikey.com, you can find a whole series of them. Osram makes them, Philips makes them, a few companies. So you don't actually have to go through what John went through. If you want to be really bright, that's another story.
K2IO with LED source.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to Eric first and then pick up Bernie in that order, and then I'm going to go back to John a little bit. What's the approximate price of these number 47 bayonet bulb replacements that are light-emitting diode type? Roughly, what's the bucks on those? Is there a minimum order from DGT? I think there isn't. So I can tell that Rich would like to keep this a not-too-expensive operation. Over to you for what do you think is the price on that, Eric? K2EJ, K2IW.
Oh, they're incredibly cheap. I think the most expensive one I ever bought was like $1.50, $2, something like that. They're not expensive.
Good information. Thank you, Eric. And Bernie, where's your favorite source of light-emitting diodes if you wanted to make your own pilot light? K2 Yankee S or K2 LIW in the TechNet?
I've had good success picking them off of eBay. I'm on the move right now, and as I ran out of my office, I checked on eBay, and there's a number of vendors that are selling 50 5-millimeter blue diodes for $2.50 delivered. I would bet that those vendors will probably also sell you the resistors. You calculate the value and tell them you need blank ohm quarter watts resistors, and you could probably get the whole mess for $3 or $4. I do like Eric's idea of if somebody's making the bayonet mount bulb, that's probably the cleanest way.
Okay, thank you, Bernie. Another approach. So the great big pile of light-emitting diodes, let's see, Bernie just told us you can get, I think he said 50 of them for $5 on eBay, which looks like other people have been down this road. And what's your favorite vendor for these light-emitting diodes? Was it DigiKey or eBay, KC2WGB, K2RW, the TechNet?
I went on eBay and I just typed in LEDs and it came up with a bunch of sources from China. I found a reasonable source there, and the multicolor is the thing. I wanted white, blue, green, as many different colors as I could get. I was able to get 30 of them. I think it was like $3, very cheap, and you can get them cheaper than that, and you can get them down to pennies.
Out of curiosity, the particular batch of 30 that you bought, did those 30 come in mixed colors, or are you buying 30 of each one of those colors? Over to you, John.
That was mixed colors. There was like 5 in each bag, and I think it was 6 bags, or maybe it was 4 bags, and a couple of duplicates, but something like that. They come packed very nice, and free shipping. You can't ask for more than that.
My RGB, John?
What was that, Eric?
He was asking you, were they RGB, red, green, and blue? Was that the 3 of the colors that you got, John?
generally what they make, RGB for colored white.
Yes. Those three colors, I also had white, and there was another color in there. It was sort of like a violet color. I don't know what color they call that. I didn't use it because it wasn't bright enough. It looked very bad in scales.
And my guess is there are even light-emitting diodes you can buy where inside of each package there's two separate bulbs, red and green, for instance. And depending on which lead you feed or which polarity you feed, you can light up each one of those at a time. So that. Screen, so to speak. I bet you've done experiments along those lines, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, I've used a lot of different kinds of literally RGB lamps. Occasionally you'll find one that's white RGB. By the way, there's three separate little dyes mounted on the little wires in there because when they make the chips, make a whole round dish full of them, thousands of them, and they slice it up, and then they, put the little gold wires between the actual sticks of the silicon and the connection. But you can get them RGB, you can get them with different color temperatures. So they're typically made as RGB, and sometimes you'll find them as RGB white. And occasionally, if you specifically, people who are doing these large displays and creating pixels out of them, you may find something that's called near violet. It's a supplement to blue. What it does is you have to use it with the blue, and it excites a little bit of phosphorus. And by the way, the blue LEDs are actually UV with that phosphorus. That's what makes it blue. The red and the green are easy to do by frequency, the tunneling in the chip, but the blue is a lot harder.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a whole lot of experiments that can be done with light-emitting diodes, and boy, are they here to stay. I recently bought a couple of flashlights that run on AAA batteries. Three AAA batteries goes into the flashlight, and my goodness, what brilliance you can get out of these things. Some of them have just one bulb in the center, with a lens in the front, and you can rotate the outer barrel so you can focus that lens as a floodlight or as a sharp beam, and very efficient, last many hours on the battery set is what I'm trying to say, and lots of light. So light-emitting diodes are here to stay. These are compact fluorescent bulbs that we're using right now is what I think is an intermediate step, and it's got mercury inside and a disposal problem. I think they're all going to eventually become light-emitting diodes. Almost all of our lighting in our house is going to be LED in the future, is what I see. And if I know you, Eric, you have already switched over. In fact, my good buddy in Dallas-Fort Worth area, he actually lives in Grand Prairie, Texas, WA5EJB. He found out that in his state of Texas, let me drop... 100-watt light bulbs became illegal to sell in the state because they really want you to stop using inefficient bulbs. But somebody found a way to get around that. You go to the right vendor, and you can buy a 99-watt incandescent light bulb. So he buys a whole lot of 99-watt incandescent light bulbs, and you can't tell the difference between it and 100-watt. But because it's not 100-watt, it's technically illegal. Not really. But what he does is he puts incandescent bulbs throughout his house in the winter time, and therefore they intentionally give off heat that heats his house, and all the lights in the house drastically cuts back the amount of gas that he has to burn, if you know what I mean. Then in the summertime, he unplugs all of his incandescent bulbs and plugs in the light-emitting diode bulbs, which run very cold, and therefore don't give heat, so that he doesn't have to fight it with air conditioning. That's kind of a crafty idea, but I pass that on to you guys. So, any other fills that you need on the subject of light bulbs and things like that? Pilot light bulbs, Rich. N2EL for any final comments. K2IW in the deck.
One quick addition, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, as Eric knows, you got to be careful when you buy the white ones. We use those on the jobs as replacements. Some of them were so bright you could not look at them. We had to either reduce that voltage or we had to go back to an older brand that did not have that brilliance. It would actually hurt your eyes to look at those white lights. They were super bright. So that's the only other comment. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGP.
OIS, comment on 100-watt light bulbs.
OIS is after Eric. KE2EJ, go ahead.
All right, John. Well, the thing that I wanted to point out, first of all, you're talking about the very bluish-white lights, actually, the color temperature is around 64,000 degrees Kelvin. The later versions of light, actually, you'll see, they call them pixels. There'll be less pixels in it, but they actually produce higher wattage. Today, we're making the LEDs. We're making 1 and 5 and now 10 watt individual LEDs. And then we also make these big arrays that can be the equivalent of 50 watts, 100 watts, things like that. So that's why that particular version, by the way, lowering the voltage doesn't necessarily dim them because they have switching supplies in them. I don't have a single fluorescent or incandescent light in my house. Everything's LED. But I gotta warn you, they got switching supplies in them, and they're not radio friendly, some of them, so you gotta be careful. P2RWK, okay.
Dick, I have to leave. The attendant is leaving, the other attendant can come in. She's gotta, legally, he has to put me in the bed. All I wanna know is, I wanna get one set of bayonet base, blue if I can get blue. Where's a good place to get them that I won't have to pay a minimum price? I don't want to have to pay $15 to ship $2 worth of equipment, and I'm going to just listen until we go.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it over to Eric on that one, because I think he's got the answer. KE2EJ, K2IW. Go ahead, Eric. And by the way, Eric, your audio sounds good tonight. All right, K2IW, K2J. Richie, go to your computer. Go to digikey.com and go to the optoelectronics section and find the bulb of your choice. I don't know if they're going to get you blue in a prepackaged form like that. They might. I haven't looked in a while. Something that is that light, I think, is either free shipping or, you know, it's through the post office in an envelope. So don't worry about it. And that's it. Just go online, find the one you want, and order it. K2RW, K2J.
Y2HF, what's comment?
OIS.
Guys, listen, I'm going to be listening because I have a tendency here from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., and the guy who's supposed to come didn't show up yet. So the guy who's supposed to leave at 8 is still here, and by law, he has to take me out of the wheelchair and put me into the bed. I'm very sorry to have to get out of here so quick. I will check DigiKey, absolutely. Thank you. Until we go, I'll be listening.
Okay, we've got to pick up OIS and then HF, or NY2H, I think it is. W2OIS, go right ahead, sir. Next slide, open your name.
Yeah, it's Mark, KC2OIS. These things with the bulbs, you know, this regulation from the energy department, it's really not a law, so we all know this, and we all know that all the bulb manufacturers, when they were told about this, then they just closed the factories and they all went to China. So, well, the go-around on the 60-watt and 100-watt, the 60 standard bulbs that they want to get rid of, first of all, you could buy the halogen bulbs that are A-lamps. They're a lower wattage, A. But B, you can get the same wattage if you buy rough service bulbs. There's a guy in New Jersey, he's in the lighting business, and he went and opened up, I guess he was ticked off at this regulation, and he's producing these rough service bulbs. You can get them in all the wattages. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, very fine, Mark. Yeah, my buddy in Texas, he intentionally wet an old-fashioned incandescent bulb, which is low in efficiency, gives off a whole lot of heat, because he's using them to heat his house literally in the wintertime. It's a way of distributing heat, and he doesn't have to, he's using I2R heating, as they say. In other words, he doesn't have to put up heating panels that run on electricity. He uses the light bulbs to do that, so he's getting light simultaneous with heat. And in the wintertime, he intentionally leaves the lights on to heat the house. Think about that, how opposite that is. So he intentionally wanted low efficiency bulbs, and you can still get them, as you can see. I'm not sure now if that was Lou or Dennis. I think it was Lou. NY2H, question mark, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, it was Dennis, NY2HF.
You got it, Dennis.
All right, what I wanted to chime in on, Dick, was that, yes, the LED flashlights are fantastic, but you have to really watch them, because what happens is the bulbs last longer than the batteries do. The batteries explode inside the casing, and, you know, if you leave them in long enough, Dick, you've got a problem. So you have to check them every once in a while by opening them up. Make sure that they haven't burst their little containers, the little battery containers, to make sure that you're not corroding the whole inside of the flashlight. The other thing I wanted to say is that I'm also on all LED, so we have a really minimum footprint here. Back to that control.
Give me a couple more words on this one, Dennis. I believe you also have a number of renewable energy resources. I think you've got photovoltaics on your house, and you're almost off the grid, at least part of the time. Is that true, Dennis? You're probably the greenest guy on the North Fork of Long Island. NY2HF, K2LIW.
Thank you, Dick. We are partially off the grid when the grid goes down. But the problem with photovoltaic is that it's tied into the grid, so once the grid goes down, it goes down also. But what we do have is quite a number of very large batteries, probably about 156 pounds each, to carry us through, plus a number of generators to, recharge them if it's an extended period of time, and also propane tanks to cook on a barbecue, so we're not using a lot of electricity with the electric cooktop. So we have a number of factors in place. We have 30 panels on the roof. We produce probably on a good day about 31,000 kilowatt hours of power. We still haven't been able to turn back the heater, but that's awful, even with all the LEDs. Back to that control.
Like 31,000 kilowatt hours?
Yeah, run that by again. On a good day, how many kilowatt hours are you generating, Dennis? This is sort of the question I think we're all asking. And what is your peak photovoltaic generating capability? Can you generate 3 kilowatts of electricity at any one instant of time with your photovoltaics? NY2HF, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Sorry, Dick, I misspoke. It's about 31 to 35 kilowatt hours in a total day, not in a short period. It's 31 to 35 kilowatt hours in a day. And we have 30 panels up on the roof. Back to net control.
Roughly what percentage of your roof is covered with photovoltaics, Dennis Grant?
I think you mean 3,100 kilowatt hours.
So it's probably about maybe 40%. The other side is facing non-south facing, so it wasn't going to get most of the light. Actually, at the time, I wanted to do more, but he said we really wouldn't get a lot out of it, so we didn't do it. But one of the things that if anybody does photovoltaic, what they should also do is something with thermal heating, with solar thermal heating, so that they can offset their hot water usage. It was a mistake, I didn't do it, and I'm still thinking of doing it. The next thing I'm going to do is I have plenty of motors here. I'm going to build a wind turbine, and that's the next thing I'm going to do, and I'm going to plug it into an electric hot water heater. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, in order for us to know what your photovoltaic system can do, rather than give it to us in kilowatt hours per day, at high noon when the sun is hitting your 35 solar panels, I think it is, what's the total number of kilowatts of instantaneous power, not kilowatt hours? How many watts can you generate at high noon from your photovoltaics, Eric? Here we go, Dennis. NY2HF, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I actually didn't do that, but that's because it's on two separate inverters. There's 20 solar panels on one inverter, and there's 10 on the next. So, as far as the watts coming in, not sure, probably about 5,000 or so, not sure. But I used to go by the kilowatt hours. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds kind of reasonable. If it was 5,000 watts, and if the day has 10 hours worth of sunlight, so to speak, 5,000 times 10 would be 50 kilowatt hours during that particular day. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric. I bet you you've thought about putting photovoltaics on your house.
So I have charged up the batteries that I usually would start with anyway. But nothing that big. You gotta figure if he's had it for a couple of years, the technology, which he's probably got, if he says he's got 30 panels, they're probably either 175 watts or possibly 200. Really expensive a couple of years ago. The price has come down a lot. So if he's got 30 of them, and each one's 200 watts, and he's got the conversion loss of the inverter. The big inverters are like 6 kilowatts. They're kind of really bulky and expensive. Typically, there's 1, 2, and 3 kilowatt inverters. That's reasonably priced that people use. If you did this independently and not through one of these other companies like Energy Solar, which is basically the people who own the generating stations, same thing with Keystone and a few others, they're doing all of this. Three, it's no charge to you. You get your electric rate for the next 20 years. You may be ahead of the curve before these companies came into being, but you can figure out from that what, you know, the total DC size is and then the loss of efficiency.
WS2N.
Yeah, Paul, recognize. Get you in a minute, Paul. Eric, what Dennis just told us, though, is that his inverters are pumping electricity back into the line and making his watt-hour meter on the house either run very, very slow or maybe even backwards sometimes. But what Dennis did tell us is that when LiPo, Loco, Con Ed, when they go down, he's off the air because his inverter system is using that as a reference. Do you know of a way that a person could make a modification to the inverter or buy a slightly different inverter such that if he's willing to use a transfer switch when his local power company is off the air, that he could be using his photovoltaic power into his inverters to power the house, and yes, he's not going to have exactly 60 hertz. His clocks might run a little bit fast or slow, but is there a way that he could run those inverters to power his house when the local power company is down? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
NY2HF, put a comment on that one, Dick.
Yeah, let me just drop this in there first. The manufacturers of the inverters are actually here. Let it drop first, Dick. They actually have outputs that drive transfer switches just for that purpose. But the problem is not just the way the electrical codes are, but the way each state has its laws and its particular codes. As far as a power company is concerned, they never want a chance of somebody feeding back into their lines when the power system is down. Because they got their guys up on a lot of things that they don't want to do. I mean, if you think about when we had Sandy or the last really big snowstorm, all the then LIPA guys came around. If they heard a generator, they made you shut your generator off just to make sure that they're happy that there's not an accident, showing an emergency like that. whether you have a transfer switch or not, they don't care. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that makes some sense. The safety issue. In my particular case, I know darn well that I have to open the transfer switch between me and the local power company when I'm using my generator, because if I didn't, I'm trying to pick up the whole block and my generator thinks that's a short circuit. If you had a double error, in other words, Con Ed is down and the power line to your particular house is also disconnected, now you can backfeed the system, and when your lineman is reestablishing things, you could get in trouble on your generator. It takes a double fault for that to create a problem. But in order to be super safe, I can see how the lineman will tell you, you've got to turn off your generator while we're doing this repair. I think you had some further comments on this one. It either was Dennis, and then it was going to be Paul in that order. NY2HF, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yes, thank you, Dick. Yes, you can throw the main power switch. You can feed a small amount of sine wave to your box, and it will trick your solar panels into thinking that the grid is there. The problem arises when the full power of the solar grid comes into your system, and say you have, I don't know, just for sake of argument, you have one microwave working, and you have probably, I don't know, 5-6 times the capacity of power coming in. It has to go somewhere. So you're either going to have to dissipate it with dummy loads or electric resistors or something. And Eric, yes, we didn't lease this roof. We bought the solar panels before all the nonsense began. So we're ahead of the curve. And yeah, we're getting a lot of power, but we have a big house. If you go on the Google, you'll see. But you know, that's one of the reasons. But that's one of the problems, Dick. If you try to pull the system into turning on, you're going to have to corral all the electricity coming through your lines. Back to you, Nick.
Two OIS questions then.
OIS, we're going to get to you after a poll. I thank you for that one, Dennis. And it would take a more modified inverter system that would lighten the load on the photovoltaic cells, so that it drew less power in the first place. I mean, if your photovoltaic cells, your panels on the roof, were lightly loaded, yes, the voltage will climb high, and if the inverter had enough capability by pulse width modulating techniques, for instance, it could lighten the load right at the source, but that's a different design, and I can see how it presents a problem. The way the system is wired right now, any excess power from the photovoltaics, the inverter runs full blast, and all excess power gets pumped back into loco. And so it takes a further modification to be able to do what I'm discussing. Let's see, Paul was next, and then OIS in that order. Paul, I wonder how far you've gone down the road with being off the grid. I'll bet you've been dreaming about that. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a Paul.
Oh, I would say half my house are LEDs now, including the architect light right that I used to put a shack, and that's right on top of the radios, no interference whatsoever. So, yeah, I just want to comment about the solar panels. I just watched a week ago on Channel 13, this old house. It was a good show. They talked about solar panels, and they put about 20 panels, I guess, on this one house, and they used something called mini inverters. So each panel had its own inverter, and so it ran down to the transfer switch. Everything ran down independently. One of the reasons for it was they said if all these panels are hooked up in series, you get like a shady spot by one of the trees. It's going to reduce the output of that one panel. If they're all hooked in series, that, you know, kind of takes out reduces the whole system at one time. These mini inverters, you know, convert everything, you know, AC, ran everything down independently, and then they link them all together, you know, in the basement. Back to you, Dick.
OI2HF with another comment.
Handler pickup Dennis after OIJ, it's Mark. And where you've got independent panels and independent inverters, I think a smart guy could find a way of just using the right number of inverters to power his house independently when the local power company is down. I think it's possible. Let's see what Mark wants to know about this. KC2OYS, K2RIW, go ahead, Mark.
I can give you a few words later.
All right, so let me ask a question here. So if there's an EMP, does all your money go down the drain, so to say? Because if you're hooked up, as I know, the county, the local government probably will not let you go totally off the grid. They in most places, they don't. Or they fine you, or they take your equipment, or they take your property, whatever they do. So what would happen if there was an EMP? How does this all work? I mean, it's great to have a lot of money to have all these things, but the average guy doesn't have this. They're going to go over to his house. I'm only kidding. Over to you, Dick.
NY2HF to comment on that, too.
Okay, we're going to go to Eric. Eric's going to have some comments on these, and then so is Dennis. So how much protection do you think is in there for a high voltage spike because of a lightning strike? And I see the possibility, if you don't have some extremely good surge protectors, a lot of electronics could be damaged. KE2EJ, KQRIW, you got it, Eric.
Yeah, I KQRIW, KQ, right? To really be off the grid, quote unquote, we're not in the Southwest, where you get more, a little more connected than more of a period of time. You need essentially, the inverters don't run off the solar panels, they run off the battery. The solar panels run the battery charger, so, you know, the battery will suck up whatever it takes, and you need sufficient amount of amp hours to carry you through a period of no sun, which could be, you know, a period of a week. But most people who set up a system like that will also have some kind of turbine or gas generator for those moments where they ain't got enough charge. So that's really the only way to get yourself off the grid. And other folks, like my friend up in Massachusetts, he likes to do windmills, like put together a geothermal system to take care of the heating, and basically take like a barrel, 55 gallon drum, and put your condensers in there and operate either with a Freon, or you could use ammonia or a number of other things that are more efficient to cool your house. K2RW, K2HF.
K2HF with a question. Hey, HUC
or HEC, we'll get to you after Dennis. NY2HF, go right ahead, Dennis.
All right, I got a different with Eric. Listen, you got more than solar, and you got more than batteries. You got wind turbines. So there is something that you can do during the downtime. As far as solar, the average amount of usable sunlight for solar is 6.5 hours, not longer than you said, Dick. The reason for microinverters in the panels is to absolutely take away the shading, because what happens is if I have one panel or half a panel that's shaded out of 20 by a tree, I lose the ability of all 20. So the microinverter allows the shading to overcome that, so that I can still have some partial usage of what's going on. There's probably a few other things that I wanted to say, but I've forgotten, so I'm going to hand it back to you, Dick.
Once a person has photovoltaics, it's very tempting to say, okay, I'll make a real good battery set that will protect me when Con Ed goes down. And when you study the physics of how much energy you can store in batteries versus how much energy you can store in a gallon of petroleum, you're way ahead of the game with a gallon of petroleum. So if you want standby power without filling up a house full of batteries, so to speak, to have a motor generator set that runs on petroleum is an awful nice way to go.
Yes, it's a lot of mixed technology to have solar voltaics, inverters, batteries, transfer relay, and now a motor generator set, and maybe a windmill also. What I think you're going to discover, Dennis, when you study the size of a windmill that can generate the kind of kilowatts that your solar voltaics can generate, it takes a pretty good-sized windmill. The windmills, the amount of power they generate, you would think it's a function of diameter squared, because diameter squared is area. I think it actually works out in the real world to be diameter cubed. So the windmills become extremely efficient, is not the right word, but large energy capability when it's a very large diameter windmill. But not many of us has the ability to put that big a diameter windmill at our house. Let's see, the next person who had a question or a comment was HEC, I think it was. Mr. HEC, give me the full call and your name, sir, and then proceed. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
KD2HUC, name is Steve. Dick, I'm listening, and my question is, usually the grid tie inverters, like you said, they get their clock synced from the incoming frequency from LIFO or Con Ed. And if you put a transfer switch in between them and, Con Ed, so that this way you can supply power when Con Ed or LIFO is down, then you would lose the ability to then, feed into the utility and of course, get the meter to go backwards. But aside from a grid tie inverter, which is very expensive with the hardware, let me let it drop. What would prevent Dennis from just adding an additional separate pure sine wave inverter, like an Exeltech, something special, onto his battery set and supply just a transfer switch with that? So that this way, when all's working the way it should, he's using the grid tie inverters so he can, any excess energy he can push back into the utility. And during an outage, when LIFO or Con Ed are not there, he would be able to throw the transfer switch and just use a regular inverter, which is of course a lot less expensive than a grid tie, and just power his house if needed off the battery set. Just asking. KD2HEC. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, I'm going to let Dennis answer that one. NY2HF, K2RIW, go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. I don't know if I got it all, but what I'm going to say is that, there is a problem, and the problem arises when you have the grid down and you have the solar power disabled because the grid's down. You don't want to, drive alignment down the line. So if you were able to tap into that power, it's a very variable power, so you have to have a way to dissipate what you weren't using, otherwise it would blow the circuits of what you were using. What I have, actually, is probably about, 16 or 20 batteries that are really high capacity. Like I say, 156 pounds each. And I have pure watt inverters. I have also modified sine wave inverters. And I also have the lesser modified or square sine inverters. So I can use them where I need them. The whole thing is that, you want to build something that's going to have the longest lasting effect. If I had the power to generate it to back up the batteries all the time, then that's not really efficient. If I had wind turbine, that would be more efficient, except for when the wind's not blowing. So there's all these things you have to weigh against each other. It becomes a real Rubik's Cube to pull it all together. So am I interested in pulling my solar panels on the roof? Thinking that the grid is there, not really, because it's going to be too much power coming through, but I am working on it. Thank you.